three.
Well, Farrakhan has said a lot of blatantly anti-Semitic things.
No, he's great.
He's great? He compared Jews to cockroaches.
No. See, that's the media. They're distorting all of it. Take my religion, for example, Scientology. They make it seem so fucking different than it is. If you just gave me, like, an hour to tell you about it, you'd be like, no fucking way. That's what Scientology is? No fucking way. In just 1 hour, I could completely change your minds.
Me and Judd looked at each other. Do we bite? Are we strong enough to be proselytized by one of the most famous and charismatic men on the planet? Would I come out of this thinking I had to expunge alien spirits from my soul?
Yeah, maybe another time.
We left soon after that, and I was driving back down his long, now dark driveway. I had passed the spot where I'd stopped to pee in the bottle when I saw it. A red light coming from the trees. I squinted. It was a video camera with its little red recording light now visible, pointing directly where I had peed. If a camera could wink, this one would have. Am I kept up at night by the thought that Tom Cruise likely has video footage of me urinating in a Snapple bottle in my car? No. But if I ever start expounding on the virtues of clearing one's thetans, you know it's bad and he's blackmailing me. The next day at work, Judd had all these ideas for Tom. I remember I was like, he's not just meeting with us. He looks crazy and he's trying to be in a comedy, so he seems in on the joke. We can't be the only ones he's talking to about this.
Maybe, but I think we could get him.
A few months later, he signed on to be in Tropic Thunder. He was hilarious, and everyone loved him again the second they saw it. Acid. I was always afraid to do acid, but dear God, I wanted to. I think the propaganda got to me. I remember hearing as a kid that if you did acid once, you could get acid flashbacks for life, that at any moment you could suddenly find yourself in the throes of hallucinogenic hysteria. I remember a kid in school telling me that if you ever did acid, you couldn't be an airplane pilot, just in case a flashback happened mid-flight. I also heard stories about bad trips, people thinking they could fly and jumping out of windows, people thinking there were spiders crawling all over them and tearing their skin off. Genuinely horrifying shit to think about confronting, especially when coupled with the fact that the other thing I'd always heard about acid was how long it lasted, over 12 hours sometimes. It had kind of a culty connotation too, so that made it scary. I remember hearing Charles Manson drugged his followers with acid so they'd become murdering brainwashed zombies, which isn't the greatest commercial for a drug. I also watched the Woodstock documentary, which captures the moment a man stands in front of the crowd specifically to warn everyone that there's some bad brown acid going around and to stay the fuck away from it. Sure, I'd heard about seeing the music, tasting the colors and that stuff, but still. Throughout high school and the years after, me and my friends steered clear, instead opting for Herculean amounts of shrooms. Shrooms had taken me on some pretty intense trips over the years, and the thought that acid was more intense made it downright terrifying to even consider. But there was always one voice in my head that stuck out, the voice of a guy at summer camp who was like, acid is way less intense than shrooms. Really? Yeah. With shrooms, you're the passenger. With acid, you're the driver. Well, I could definitely attest to the first part, but I straight up didn't believe the second part. As I got older, I got more curious, and I found myself around people who were on acid from time to time, and they didn't seem like they'd jump out of a window or tear their skin off. They actually seemed coherent and like they were having a fucking great time. So, because I'm wildly on the nose at the age of 36, me and some friends who had never done acid all booked a place in Joshua Tree to try it for the first time. My friend Ben flew in from Vancouver and we planned to arrive on Friday morning, get the place ready, and then Kyle, Ariel, and Evan would come in the afternoon. We'd take the acid at around 4 p.m. and then see what happened. We got to the Yucca Valley, where there's a giant military base and a fuck ton of barber shops and very sketchy looking massage parlors, giving the impression that this town had a lot of well-groomed servicemen who love themselves a hand job. Which is good, I guess. I want our armed forces to be clean cut and not in any way sexually pent up. We found a health food store and bought whatever we could find that seemed tasty. We weren't really sure what we'd want to eat. Drugs and food mix differently depending on what you're on. On most drugs, you can just avoid eating altogether. But acid lasts so fucking long that we were going to have to eat eventually. We were anxious about doing the acid, as doing any new drug is scary. I was particularly nervous because a few weeks earlier, at Martin's place, I had a wild fucking time on shrooms, and I was still a bit shell-shocked. My friend Martin had just moved into a new house with a pool, and me and Evan and our friend Andrew made a plan to go to Martin's, eat a bit of shroom chocolate, get a tour of the new house, and then go hang out by the pool as the shrooms kicked in and just overall have a chill night. We got to Martin's and he had rose-shaped shroom chocolates waiting for us.
There's gold caps in here.
How much?
I'm not sure exactly.
We each ate a chocolate and began the tour. As we were admiring the sconces in the guest room, we all looked at each other. Are you guys really starting to feel this shit?
I'm very much starting to feel it.
This shit is coming on hard and fast as a motherfucker. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
We couldn't even finish one lap of the house. I went down to the dining room and held on to the table for dear life. My hands melted into the wood up to the wrist, and the swirly patterns of the grain started to work its way up my arms. No matter how many times I shook my head, the hallucination stuck. Holy fuck. Andrew appeared holding a sword, which is never a good thing while on shrooms.
Look at the size of this letter opener.
I laughed hysterically till I wept. I looked at the time. It had only been 20 minutes since we had eaten the chocolate. This was just starting and was going to get steadily more intense for the next few hours. Good Lord, I was in for it. My brain felt like it was ripped out of my head and thrown into a kaleidoscope. I struggled to operate doors, light switches, faucets, simple things I've had a pretty good handle on for quite some time. I lay on a lawn chair for hours, weeping about how much I miss seeing my wife and my dog due to my work schedule, and then the next day I quit two jobs because I had the cosmic revelation that they weren't great uses of my time. When you're so high, you're calling your employer the next day to quit your job, you know you've done a lot of drugs. Me and Ben drove from the grocery store to the house we rented near the outskirts of Joshua Tree National Park. When we got there, it kind of reminded me of where Sarah Connor's friends live in Terminator 2, the place with the underground bunker where Arnold gets the minigun. It had a bit of a survivalist vibe, but it also had an outdoor fireplace, so we were psyched. The others arrived and Evan pulled out the acid. It was on tiny little paper tabs, which surprised me for some reason. We each took a tab and put it on our tongue. It was one of those moments when I thought, I've only ever seen this in movies, and it always looked exactly like this, which is also what I'll probably think when a tsunami wipes out Los Angeles. I was scared shitless. My heart was pounding. I strapped myself in and was pleasantly surprised. It came on a bit weird, with a bit of a chemical-y feeling, but around an hour and a half after we took it, we were fully in the throes, and it was wonderful. It was way less intense than shrooms, at least the amount I had been taking, and although I was decidedly fucked off my ass, I did in fact feel like I was in the driver's seat. For the most part. The time came to eat. We were starving, which again was kind of a surprise. We all went to the kitchen and laid out what we had gotten at the health food store. Tortillas, chicken breast, potatoes, feta cheese.
What the fuck is this?
I'm not sure.
What did you plan on making?
Well, I'm not sure. We didn't really talk about it.
Why not?
We've been fucking stressed out all day about doing this fucking acid.
The nerves got to us.
We weren't thinking right.
No shit. These groceries don't make sense. There's no meal you can even make with this.
Sure there is.
What? It's like some fucked up Top Chef challenge. Do acid and make a meal with a bunch of ingredients that don't make sense. We're gonna starve to death.
No, shut up. I got this. We're having fucking Greek chicken tortillas with mashed potatoes. Don't worry. I got this.
As we sat in the living room, we could hear Ben working hard around the corner. After about 20 minutes, he yelled,
Guys, this is going to be fucking gross.
After dinner, even though there was room for each of us to have our own bedroom, we all gathered in a little bunk room together. It felt like camp. except every time I closed my eyes, I saw spider legs appear and peel away layers of reality, but in a not at all scary way. Whenever it got unpleasant, I could steer it away, because again, with acid, I felt like I was in the driver's seat. With shrooms, at best I'm in the passenger seat, but more often I'm strapped to the hood, holding on for dear life. My first experience was great, and I did the perfect amount, but there was this nagging thought in my head. It's not a great thought, but one that I stand by. You haven't really done a drug until you've done a bit too much of it. Luckily, the next year at Burning Man, I did too much acid. If you don't know, Burning Man is essentially a giant art festival. To get there, you drive an RV to the middle of fucking nowhere in the Nevada desert, and then turn off the only road and go 2 hours further into what's really the middle of fucking nowhere. They sell nothing and have nothing other than porta-potties. No plumbing, no garbage cans, no stores, no water. You bring everything you need, and you dispose of everything you use in your own camp and take it all with you when you leave. They call it radical self-reliance, but it's mostly just eating a ton of microwavable burritos for 3 days straight. I completely get why people are annoyed by the concept of it, and before I went, I was too. But ultimately, it's a drug wonderland, so it won me over. Whatever Disneyland is for kids who like cartoons is what Burning Man is to adults who like hallucinogens. Mostly, you ride bikes around the moon-like landscape, high off your fucking ass, going from one giant art installation to the next, which is pretty much the most fun thing one can do. About 15 of our friends made a camp on the outskirts of the festival, and the sun was setting. I took 2 hits of acid. About 20 minutes later, it came on fast. My first trip was a beautiful, if not tiny bit rocky, metamorphosis from sober to high. This felt more like a scene in a movie where someone turns into a werewolf. I wanted to tear my clothes off. I had to remind myself to breathe. The thought of engaging in any sort of conversation was appalling. As my friends congregated to go out for the night, I stood alone, looking out into the desert, thinking, what the fuck did I just do to myself? About 5 minutes later, I was just really high. I thought, as long as I don't have to navigate any actual high-stakes situation that require my brain or common sense or anything, I'll be fine. Unfortunately, Burning Man does have actual high-stakes situations that require your brain and common sense because, well, they burn shit. It's actually the worst part about Burning Man to me, which makes it confusing in that it's their titular selling point. It'd be like if an art gallery was bragging about the fact they were going to destroy all the art after the exhibition was over. It's a strange stance. Even stranger is the feeling that some of this shit was made just to be burned, which is maybe poetic to some people, but not to me. A festival brought to you by the weirdo you hung out with as a kid who poured lighter fluid on all his toys and then melted them. Fantastic. Lauren and me were still high on acid. Her, the perfect amount, and me, still a bit too much, but stabilizing. We were watching a giant 4-story structure be burned to the ground when suddenly the wind shifted and giant pieces of flaming debris started to rain down on the area we were in. People scrambled for cover, but the fire kept falling. Flaming whirlwinds whipped through the crowd. It was pandemonium. We spotted some cop SUVs parked a few hundred yards away and ran behind them trying to take cover. The cops were afraid to damage their cruisers, I guess, so they hopped in and drove away from the scene, leaving us exposed again. As we held hands and ran as fast and far as we could into the desert to escape the flaming wood pieces that were falling all around us, one thought kept rolling through my mind. Thank fucking God I'm not on shrooms right now. All this likely begs the questions, what's wrong with you, Seth? Why do you do so many drugs? And why can't you stop talking about it? The best answer to that I can come up with is they give me insights into my own thinking, feeling, and behavior in ways that I haven't found elsewhere, and they're super fun. It's really nothing new. People have been getting fucked up for thousands of years. There's something about removing myself from my normal baseline of operation that feels exciting and adventurous. And shared adventures can be incredibly bonding. I also think I keep yapping about drugs like acid, MDMA, and shrooms because of how incredibly fucking bothered I am that they're viewed as these big bad wolves compared to alcohol, which is both way more prevalent and way more shitty for you. Like, if I told you there was a drug that you drank and it made you have fun for like an hour, then it made you dizzy for 3 hours, then you blacked out, then the entire next day you had a terrible headache and generally felt like shit, you probably wouldn't be clamoring to try it. But alcohol is so mainstream that it's somehow overcome the fact that it sucks, which is also how I hope to be described one day. But in all seriousness, if I have 2 glasses of wine, I feel like shit the next day, and the sugar and carbs are objectively bad for your health. I've done so much acid that the desert itself crashed like waves on a beach. It has no sugar, no carbs. In fact, the next day, I felt fucking fantastic. Waz and the Magic Castle. I'd acted in a lot of movies, but I had not played a real person before. Then in 2015, I got cast to play Steve Wozniak in the film Steve Jobs. I was worried about meeting him at first. I didn't want him to be bummed out that I was playing him. Everyone else had such better actors portraying them. Michael Fassbender, Kate Winslet. Woz got me. Luckily, he seemed happy with the casting, and meeting him was a true trip. He was the first inventor I'd ever met. And he didn't invent just anything. He invented the personal computer. And to make this paragraph truly repetitive, I'll go on to say he didn't just invent the personal computer. He conceived of it. When Woz was a kid, computers were roughly the size of an elephant and cost about $1 million. So the idea of owning one was far-fetched. It would kind of be like wanting to own a locomotive, as in not something anyone could imagine a private citizen owning. Computers were for NASA, not teenagers. But he wanted one, so badly that he created one. His brilliant mind was able to take circuit boards that were a couple of feet across and rewire them with such artful efficiency that you could hold them in the palm of your hand. His desire to own a computer is the reason we all have one today. One of the real revelations I had after meeting him was that he was one of the first famous nerds. And as someone who grew up watching Revenge of the Nerds and its sequel, Nerds in Paradise, more than I should have, it was a shocking revelation. Almost every impression of a nerd that you saw in the 80s was kind of based on him. And it made him instantly familiar and kind of nostalgic feeling. He was friends with the first hackers, and he knew how to use whistles to trick the phone company into letting him make free long-distance calls. He even prank-called the Pope once. Woz also has prosopagnosia, also known as face blindness, which is a condition that doesn't let you remember people's faces, which is also hilarious. He makes it very clear he has this every time you see him because he doesn't want to seem rude if you've met and he doesn't instantly recognize you.
Hi, have we met? I don't remember faces.
Woz loves music, and in the 80s, he created the Modern Music Festival. The US Festival was the first one with good sound, no matter where in the massive venue you were, the first to have giant screens to see the acts, even if you were in the back row. It was even the first to have widely available bathrooms and running water. So, the next time you're at Coachella, thank Woz. Also, why would you go to Coachella? He booked amazing acts, Talking Heads, The Police, Tom Petty, The Grateful Dead, and more. It drew a crowd of over 425,000 people. He spent $12.5 million of his own money to put the festival on, and after all was said and done, he lost $10 million on it.
It was a math error,
he told me. So what did he do? He doubled down. And the following year, he put on another festival, which was twice as big as the first, held on Memorial Day weekend in 1983. The next US Festival brought in acts like David Bowie, U2, Van Halen, and The Clash. It turns out whatever mathematical snafu happened the first time happened again. And overall, he lost more than $20 million. But Woz didn't give a fuck.
It was so fun. I met David Lee Roth.
Ironically, Much like a lot of Apple computers themselves, Woz's skill set became kind of obsolete not long after it had become revolutionary. Technology caught up with him. The world no longer needed the ability to turn giant circuit boards into tiny ones. He had done it. They were small now. The film we were making explored the relationship between Woz and Jobs, among other things. One of its main ideas was technical abilities versus salesmanship and branding. Jobs was one of the greatest salesmen of all time, and he happened to be friends with the guy who made one of the most important inventions of all time. That was the magic. A technical genius was close with a marketing genius. But the marketing genius, not shockingly, took the spotlight, the acclaim, and a lot of the money. I had no idea that Jobs himself had literally no technical skills when it came to computers. I assumed he had done something.
Nope, he didn't know how to do any of that. That wasn't his thing.
I would always prod Woz about any resentment or jealousy he might have had. He wouldn't budge.
I loved Steve.
Finally, after hours of pestering him one day, I got a story. Years after Woz left Apple, in the late 80s, he invented the first universal remote control for televisions. He wanted to make a plastic mold for the prototype. Steve Jobs had a guy who made the plastic mold prototypes for all his Apple products. Woz had gotten to know the guy and knew he was the best there was. Otherwise, Steve wouldn't like him so much. He dropped off the specs, but a few days later got a call from the mold guy.
I can't do it.
What? Why not?
Steve came in and saw your prototype on the shelf and asked what it was, and I told him it was your remote. And he said that I couldn't do both. I had to either do his stuff or your stuff. So I have to do his stuff.
Basically, Woz told me that this personal slight upset him more than the fact that the average person had no sense of his real contribution to society as we know it.
I never got why he did that. That really bothered me. I mean, I found another guy to do the remote mold, and it was fine, but still.
Few months after the movie had wrapped, I was back in L.A. and got an email from Woz. He and his wife wanted to hang out with Lauren and me. They invited us to the Magic Castle. I was thrilled, but a little nervous. The last time I had been to the Magic Castle was a complete disaster. And before you start asking, what the fuck is the Magic Castle? Don't worry, I got you. The Magic Castle is a social club for magicians that was built into the side of the Hollywood Hills. The building itself is a bit of a magic trick, in that from the outside it looks like a small chalet, but once you get inside, it's a massive social space with bars, theaters, and a steakhouse. Getting inside can be tricky. Feel free to burn this book. You actually need to be invited by a member, and in order to be a member, you have to be a magician. I'd been a few times with small groups, but the year before the Woz invite, I had taken a bunch of people I work with for a night of magic and narcotics. We all took MDMA, and it hit my friend James really hard. He looked like a sweaty disaster and could barely follow a conversation. We got in the front door and stood in line for the close-up magic theater, which holds about 30 people. This shit was no joke. I turned to James. Hey, James, you okay?
What? Yeah?
Are you okay?
Yeah, cool. I'm fine.
Look, if anyone asks you if you want to volunteer or be part of the show in any way, shape, or form, say no.
Why?
Because you're fucked, man. You just can't do it. You gotta lay low.
Okay, cool. No problem.
A waitress walked up to us.
Hey, the close-up magic show is about to start. Any of you want to volunteer to be part of the show?
I'd love to.
And they took him away. Evan came over.
Where are they taking him?
He volunteered.
For what?
To be part of the fucking show.
Whew, man. I'm fucked right now. And I have a way higher tolerance than James, so he must be super fucked right now.
He is.
Fuck.
The waitress returned.
We're ready to seat you for the show.
We all filed into the small theater. On the stage was a table and chair. In the chair was James, rolling his fucking face off, smiling ear to ear. We took our seats.
This is going to be a disaster.
The magician came out and could instantly see that James was fucked up. But he was in his 60s and very seasoned looking. So he gave James a look like, I'm a pro. I've done this for decades. I've seen fucked up people before and I can handle them. It's part of the fun. Let's do this.
Pick a card. From where? from this deck.
Where in the deck?
Anywhere in the deck.
I'm not sure which one to pick.
He gave James a card.
It's, fine. Here's your card. Remember your card.
What?
Remember the card.
What card?
This card, the one in your hand.
This one? The Two of Hearts? Remember that?
Yes, but don't tell me the card, okay? Just pick another card.
What do I do with this card?
Just put it back.
Am I supposed to remember it?
No.
Okay, because I don't.
Wow.
In real time, we were able to watch the seasoned performer discover that he had in fact been doing magic a long time. So long, there were new drugs that he had never encountered before. Drugs that his old techniques wouldn't work on. Drugs that might render the very concept of magic obsolete. After all, what fun is sleight of hand when you can barely see or understand what the fuck is going on anyway? A potato chip is impressive when you're on great drugs. Magic is just a lot of effort and deception. The show ended with a long trick that James ruined by accidentally showing the card to the magician. We left immediately after, and I was worried I'd never be welcomed back. So, when me and Lauren and Woz and his wife Janet showed up and were welcomed in with no objections from the management, I was psyched. I knew Woz was pretty famous, but to magicians, Woz is a king. Magicians are huge nerds, and Woz is literally nerd patient zero. He was bombarded by fans asking for autographs from the second we walked into the club, and he would oblige by taking out and signing uncut sheets of counterfeit American $2 bills that a friend of his had printed because, again, nerds. He watched the magic with awe and delight, audibly exclaiming during every trick, "Ah, wah, ah." After about 5.5 hours of watching magic shows with the Wozniaks, we headed out of the club toward the valet. We handed our stub to the attendant, but the Wozniaks just kept walking toward the dark parking lot. You guys didn't valet?
No, actually we segued.
You what?
Segued. We're staying at the W Hotel a few miles up Hollywood Boulevard, so we just segued here. Want to see?
Yeah. They led us across the parking lot to a corner where, propped up against a little shed, were two old Segways. Bet you got on the Segway bandwagon pretty early.
Oh, you bet. These are the first Segways. See?
He showed me the serial numbers on the handlebars, 001 and 002. Wow, the first two Segways.
Yeah, the only thing is they didn't create any sort of headlight till later models, so we have to use these.
He pulled two flashlights out of his jacket pocket and gave one to his wife. With one hand operating the Segway, the other holding a flashlight, they drove off, looking as silly and happy as two people could. Steve Jobs might have gotten more money, recognition, and a better actor to play him. But still, Woz came out on top. Jewish Summer Camp. If you've ever met a Jewish person, there's a good chance you've heard them talk about Jewish summer camp. If you've never met a Jewish person, I recommend it. They're great, and they don't make bread out of baby's blood unless the baby has extra tasty blood. Jewish summer camp is somewhat mystifying, mostly because of the degree to which Jews just fucking love it. The fact that the combination of the terms Jews and camps hasn't diminished our enthusiasm is a real testament to how psyched on the whole notion we are. I think there are a few reasons for the popularity. One is that a lot of Jews love nothing more than the idea of making more Jews and nothing less than the idea of there being fewer Jews. And since Jews don't proselytize, largely because I imagine the idea of being a missionary is a big turnoff to Jews who are notoriously finicky travelers, their best shot of keeping their numbers at an acceptable level is by having their kids impregnate / be impregnated by other Jews and birth little Jews, or Jeems, as we call them. This is not true. And a very good place to plant the seeds for this is Jewish camp. I know what you're thinking. That's fucking gross. Sending your kid to camp with any thought toward them fucking is super duper weird. And I would say in return, yes, it is pretty fucking gross and super duper weird. And what's even weirder is that these people aren't even that religious. So why are they so invested in Jewish demographics? I don't know. It makes no sense. Jews are strange. But it doesn't matter. You still feel at peace around the other Jews. I think of my friend who lives in L.A. with corgis, which are those funny short-legged dogs. She read about a corgi farm where you can take your corgi to herd sheep. Since her dog had lived its whole life in Hollywood, she assumed it would stare at the sheep and maybe brag to them about how efficient the route it took to the farm was. But to her amazement, her corgi instantly started herding, as if just being in this environment tapped into some primal instinct, which is also what it's like being Jewish. Whether you like it or not, it's in you. It shows up on DNA tests. They can find a severed finger and determine if it was once attached to a Jewish hand. It's not like other religions in that way. Even if you don't believe in Judaism, you, my friend, are still a Jew. You can't really opt out of it. Maybe that's why Jews are Jew-ish. It's more vague and casts a wider net than other religions. I'm a Hindu. I'm a Muslim. I'm Jew-ish. Less commitment is involved when ish is in the mix. I'm not starving. I'm hungry-ish. I'm not freezing. I'm coldish. I'm not a Jew, but I'm for sure Jewish. Who isn't? Even Idris Elba does some things that are Jewish. And to my first point, I can't deny the Jew breeding theory works. My sister met her husband at Jew camp, and my two Jewish nephews are the direct result of this Jew expansion strategy, which will hopefully lead to what we Jews refer to as Jewtopia. My particular Jewish summer camp, Camp Miriam, was modeled after a kibbutz, which is kind of like a Jewish commune. On a kibbutz, everyone has a job, and in exchange, you get room and board, education for your kids, and some extra cash. So, in summer camp form, you get a place where the entire infrastructure, from the cooking to the cleaning to the maintenance, is handled by kids aged 8 to 15 and led by counselors aged 17 to 19, which, looking back, is batshit fucking insane. It's like leaving your dog in the care of a slightly bigger dog in a facility that is managed by dogs of various sizes. That analogy ran out of steam fast, but you get the idea. My first year going, when I was 10, I got a job in the kitchen as a dishwasher, operating one of those industrial contraptions that is about the size of a pinball machine with a giant guillotine door that you raise and lower with a big handle. It made me feel very adult, mostly because I was doing a job that absolutely should only have been done by an adult. I did not clean those dishes well. The fact that the entire camp didn't die of some sort of dysentery is amazing and really bucks some stereotypes about Jewish immune systems. For the most part, the counselors were the sons and daughters of Vancouver hippies, but every once in a while, we got an Israeli fresh out of the army who seemed bent on repaying whatever Full Metal Jacket type hazing they'd received on soft Canadian Jewish boys, the absolute softest of all Jewish boys who are already predisposed to being soft as fuck. Israeli Jews are different. They're not fluffy like North American Jews. They're sinewy and leathery. They have bodies like Madonna, veiny, lean, and immersed in the ways of Kabbalah. Also, they're aggressive and they would essentially torture us using three demented techniques that I assume were cooked up by Mossad agents hoping to extract sensitive information. The first is the typewriter, which involves pinning your child victim to the ground with a knee over each of his arms to incapacitate him. Then, you tap on the child's chest, hard, as though you are Tom Hanks testing out a vintage Imperial, and then slap the child in the face to reset the reel. Yes, that is a reference to Tom Hanks' well-known love of antique typewriters. The next is the waffle, which requires a racket of some sort, tennis, badminton, what have you, and a hairbrush. Subdue the child in a similar manner to the typewriter, lay the racket across his bare chest or back or anywhere, really, then scrub over the area with the brush. Remove the racket, and you have a waffle. The last is the windmill, which requires a broom handle, baton, yardstick, or something of the sort. Wedgie the small defenseless Jewish child to the degree that their underpant leg holes are exposed above the waistband of their Umbro shorts. Then, weave the broom handle or other implement through the exposed leg holes. And now twist. Once the traumatized Jewish child's screams reach a deafening point, release. If all has gone right, the elasticity of the child's underpants should unwind, causing the broom handle to spin like a windmill. I learned every swear word there is at camp. I thought cock was a vagina up until then, so that was valuable information. Made friends I still have to this day and can still operate most industrial dishwashing equipment fairly competently. Remarkably, this place that basically amounted to a Jewish Lord of the Flies, Lord of the Rise, Lord of the Mutzabrise, I'll workshop this, went largely without incident. That is, if you overlook the terrible, terrible incident that happened in 1997. Halfway through every summer, we would go on what was known as a tiyul, which was essentially a three-night camping trip. Now, as much as Jews love camp, I'd say they generally have an inverse relationship with camping, which is a very different activity. Camp had a swimming pool, bathrooms, a tetherball court. Camping doesn't have jack fucking shit, and every year things would go wrong. In 95, we were supposed to hike 5 hours to a lake where we would camp, drinking water from the lake itself. We hiked all day to get to the lake, and when we arrived, were alerted that the lake had beaver fever, which not only rhymes, but also involves the word beaver and makes you shit yourself for days on end, so it's hands down the most hilarious of diseases. But at the time, it wasn't cool. We couldn't camp there, so we hiked back to our starting point, which was the parking lot of a ski resort, where we slept until a bus could be organized to come pick us up. Can't get much worse than this. In 97, we were 15 and our counselors were 17, which again is like entrusting a kitten to a ferret. The plan for Tiul was needlessly ambitious. We were to take a ferry to Vancouver Island and hike the Juan de Fuca Trail, which is a 29-mile trail that winds along the forested mountainous coast. There are no services anywhere along the trail, and its current website describes it as difficult and strenuous for a 4-day hike. We were going to do it in 3, which meant we needed to do about 10 hours of hiking a day. The first day was hard, but not yet disastrous. It drizzled as we camped out under the tarps on Mystic Beach, and in the middle of the night, we snuck out in the woods to eat a giant bag of Sour Patch Kids, which were contraband. The next morning, we started early. British Columbia is technically a rainforest, which might sound odd until you're trudging through one of its many forests as it pisses rain. The already difficult and strenuous hike was becoming super fucking hard and pretty fucking dangerous. The trail turned into slippery mud. Because it's the worst possible thing that could have happened, we were halfway through the second day of our 3-day hike, putting us 14 miles into the 29-mile trail, making our way across a narrow cliffside in a single-file line when I heard one of the counselors, Jono, yell,
"Everybody stop at the clearing up ahead."
We gathered in a little seaside ravine, and another counselor, Zoe, came running up to the group of us, roughly 25 kids. She looked spooked.
Aviva Strubrisky fell. She sprained her ankle really fucking bad and passed out from the pain.
I went to elementary school with Aviva, and this added up. Once paramedics had to come give her smelling salts in Hebrew class in 4th grade because she fainted. Also, I had a crush on Aviva, so I was particularly invested in her and her consciousness and her ankle and her overall well-being. We bombarded Zoe with questions.
Is it bad? We don't know. She's unconscious.
Well, that seems pretty fucking bad.
What do we do?
I don't fucking know.
Well, if you don't fucking know, then who does fucking know?
Ugh, I don't fucking know.
Well, what the fuck?
Yeah, what the fuck is right?
Jono yelled from up the trail.
She's awake.
Zoe ran off, leaving us with another counselor, Dan, a very sensitive lefty Jew. He was starting to hyperventilate a little. All the campers looked at each other, and I'm pretty sure all of us were thinking, remember when Dan broke down crying as he sang Indigo Girls at the campfire last Friday? Yeah, he's not going to deal with this well. Zoe ran back.
She's awake, but she can't walk.
Saul Moskovich started to freak out a bit.
Great! We're going to fucking die out here!
Yaron, an Israeli kid who barely spoke English, went up to Zoe.
I am good in woods and forest. I will go to find service road. I will get help.
Dan, the sensitive lefty, seemed to be nearing a panic attack and jumped at the chance to be active.
Yes, perfect. You all wait here, and me and Yuren will come back with help.
Before anyone could settle on whether it was actually a good idea or not, they marched out into the woods, and I was 99% sure I'd never see them again. Zoe unzipped her backpack and produced a signal flare, the kind where you pull a string and it shoots an orange ball of fire in the air.
If we see a boat on the coast, we can shoot this off. We only have one, though.
I thought, wow, this is a real emergency if we are resorting to signal flares. And I also thought, please, God, let me shoot off the signal flare. I'd only seen them in movies, and although it was a clear sign of how dire things were, I thought it was cool as fuck.
Don't worry,
Zoe said.
Euron and Dan will be back with help soon.
5 hours later, Euron and Dan still hadn't come back. I pictured Euron eating Dan's corpse in the woods, but then realized Dan's corpse wouldn't technically be kosher, so he probably wouldn't do that. The mood was shifting from this is a crazy story to wow, this is a potentially fucked up story. The rain was pouring down harder than ever, and a few of the kids were beginning to show signs of hypothermia. Zoe pulled me and Ben, my best friend, away from the group.
Jonna wants to talk to you too.
We followed her about 5 minutes back up the trail, and the whole time I'm thinking, what do they want with me? Did they single me out as the leader of the kids? The smartest of the group, being invited into some sort of think tank to figure out how to handle things? We rounded a narrow rock corner and saw Jono with Aviva, who was lying in the mud going in and out of consciousness. Jono produced a small axe and thrust it into my hand. He looked at me and Ben.
You're the two largest kids in the group. Chop down two trees. We're going to lay a tarp over them and make a stretcher and carry her out the way we came.
What do you mean?
You heard me.
I've never chopped down a fucking tree.
Nobody here has, obviously.
Jews?
We can't carry her out of here.
We couldn't even walk to here without someone getting hurt. And we weren't yet carrying an injured person, which I assume will make this whole shit a lot fucking harder.
There's no other plan. We gotta get out of here.
It took us about 30 minutes to chop down the first tree, which was around the thickness of my arm. We hacked it into an 8-foot piece, which we could barely lift on our own. I looked at Ben.
Yo, dude, this is only one half of the stretcher, and there's no teenage girl lying in it yet. How the fuck are we gonna carry the whole thing out? We can barely carry this.
Maybe once she's in there, the weight will distribute it all out properly.
I didn't really know what the fuck that meant, but at the time, it seemed to make sense. A half hour later, tree number two came down, and it was getting dark. The girls in the group had started to burn their tampons for warmth, as they were the only dry and flammable things we had. We tied the tarp to our tree trunks and laid our stretcher next to Aviva, who was shivering as her eyes rolled back in her head. Me, Jono, Ben, and Zoe heaved Aviva into the stretcher. We gripped the trunks and hoisted, lifting her off the wet ground. We all looked at each other.
All right, we've got a rough 12 hours ahead of us, but we can do this if we work together and don't give up.
We started the march, and after 3 steps, Jono slipped in the mud, sending Aviva to the ground with a thud.
Fuck, sorry. Aviva, you okay?
Pained grumble. All right, let's try again. We all gripped the stretcher.
This is going to be harder than we thought, but we got this. Let's do it!
Again, we hoisted. Again, we walked a few steps, and again, we slipped, ate shit, and dropped Aviva in the cold mud from, like, 3 feet off the ground. It had been around 20 minutes, and we'd moved about 7 feet and arguably fucked Aviva up more than she'd already been fucked up, and she was already pretty fucked up. This shit just didn't seem like it was going to happen. And then I saw something. On the horizon, out on the ocean, lights. It was a ship. Miles and miles away, but there it was. It was my moment.
Give me the signal flare!
So we reached into her bag and slammed it into my hand. I leapt to the edge of the cliff, held the flare high above my head with one hand, gripped the ripcord with the other, and yanked! Now, if I had to list the most disappointing moments of my life, which I don't, but if I did, they would be. 1. Seeing the Super Mario Brothers movie in the theater as a child. 2. Meeting George Lucas. 3. This shit with the signal flare. What looked like a half-lit candle rose about 20 feet in the air and then crashed down into the ocean below. It was so unremarkable, there was no chance that the ship saw it. I barely saw it, and it happened right in front of me. We were fucked. I remember thinking, if we die out here, maybe they'll rename the trail after us. That would be nice. The Juan de Juca Trail, I'll workshop this too. Then we heard footsteps from up the trail. They got louder and louder until four giant, beautiful, strong men in their 50s came around the corner. In my head today, they all looked like Captain Sully Sullenberger, the dude who heroically landed a plane in the Hudson River and is the subject of an insane Clint Eastwood film where the climax happens 5 minutes into the movie. The four men stopped in their tracks.
What's happened?
Is there a problem?
Jonu approached the Sullies. Sully?
Yeah, this girl just hurt her ankle and went into shock. Can you help?
Sully 3 stepped forward.
Of course we can. We're goddamn fucking firemen.
I'm sure he didn't actually say it like that, but it felt like he did. And they were, for real, goddamn fucking firemen. The Sully instantly sprang into action as a fireman Sully is wont to do.
There's a service road 1 kilometer from here. We can carry her using the stretcher you guys made.
Booyah, I'm a hero.
Just give us 5 minutes to rebuild it and make it functional.
Fuck you, Sullies. I thought we had a good thing going.
It's great you guys stayed together. Very smart. The worst thing you could have done is split up.
Yeah, well, technically we did, I guess. Split up a bit.
What in the name of God do you mean?
Another counselor and camper went off into the woods to try to find help. You didn't see them as you were coming, did you?
No.
No.
Fuck.
There are 2 kids out there?
Well, a kid and a counselor.
How old is the counselor?
17.
Oh, no. That's 2 kids.
It dawned on us that Yaron and Dan being lost in the woods might actually be a way, way worse situation than Aviva being passed out on the path. The Sullenbergers led us about 40 minutes through the woods, carrying Aviva in a way that was so effortless, it made me legitimately mad. The whole time, they were questioning the possible whereabouts of the missing kids.
Did they say which way they were going?
No.
Did they have a map or anything?
No.
The Sullenbergers led us up and over a small rocky face where we found a dark, abandoned trucker's road.
All right, now we trek up the road and maybe we can flag down a...
The flashing of emergency lights became visible in the distance. Around the bend came an ambulance. Even better, Yaron and Dan were in the front seat. Not only did they not die, they came with help. Sort of. Dan and Yaron had somehow made it to the main road, hitchhiked to a nearby small-town hospital, and got their 1 ambulance and a single emergency pickup truck to come and help us. Aviva was loaded in, along with Abby Salzberg and Lauren Hirschfield, who were showing signs of hypothermia.
All right, we're going to take them back to the hospital.
What about us?
The ambulance driver looked over at the remaining freezing, wet children. He clearly had no clue what to do. I guess the magnitude of the situation was kind of hard to comprehend. A lot had to go wrong to make 30 people need rescuing, and a lot did. We needed a bus or something, and I guess that wasn't easy on short notice. The ambulance driver turned to the dude in the pickup truck.
Chris, you stay with them. Help them till we're able to get enough resources together to get everyone to safety.
Chris was maybe 20 and looked like a young James Marsden, which was to say he was not Jewish, which at this point was very comforting. The last Gentiles we had encountered had been immensely helpful. Chris looked at us, and again, somehow, me and Ben were chosen, because again, I think at that age, height becomes associated with skill and intelligence. I've always been pretty tall, which I took for granted until I recently tried to set up my short friend.
How tall is he?
My female friends would ask, often before any other questions. What does that matter? I was offended on his behalf. He's short. Who cares?
Easy for you to say. I gotta date a short dude and always wonder, was there a taller version of this same dude out there somewhere?
Brutal, but good point. On this particular day, my height made me seem capable and maybe slightly more mature than the other kids, which Chris would soon see was very far from the case. He addressed the group.
All right, I'm going to take these 2 guys in my truck to the lot up the road, which is a 5-minute walk. We're going to start a fire, and by the time you all get there, we'll have it set up to keep you warm until they can get a bus to take you all somewhere safe.
Me and Ben climbed into the front of the pickup truck. We rounded the bend and pulled into a big dirt lot.
Make a pile of wood.
It's all wet, dude.
With Christian swagger.
Don't worry.
We threw all the branches and logs we could find in a big pile while Chris went to the truck. He came back with a bright red canister about the size of a bowling pin. It said gasoline in black letters on the side.
All right, get back.
Chris doused the pile with gas and tossed in a match. It roared to life, but because it was still raining like crazy, it instantly started to die out. So Chris dumped more gas on the fire. But this time, the fire crawled up the stream of pouring gas, reaching the can, engulfing it in flames.
Fuck!
He dropped the flaming can, which started rolling back toward the pickup truck, where it would very clearly settle to a stop directly underneath the gas tank, blowing up the truck and likely killing us all.
Stop it!
How?
Grab it!
It's on fire!
It kept rolling toward the truck. I had to act. I ran up and kicked the gas can as hard as I could away from the truck, sending it bouncing across the parking lot, leaving a 30-foot-long, 8-foot-tall wall of flames behind it. The rest of the campers came around the bend and were shocked to see what I imagine looked like a solid episode of Game of Thrones, though they were over a decade away from understanding that awesome reference. Although unruly, the firewall kept us warm until a series of fire trucks showed up and took us to a fire station where they had cots and soup and those thick wool blankets you see in disaster movies. We weren't at shiny foil blanket level disaster, which I'm still thankful for. Because once those shiny foil blankets come out, you know the shit has really hit the fan. They eventually took us to a hotel where we got to use a payphone to call our parents and spend the night before we were all taken back to camp. We were on the local news and our rescue was officially deemed a provincial emergency. Dan, the lefty Jew, had a meltdown when we got back and left for 3 days to get his mind together. Aviva was back at camp after 2 days and she seemed impressed that I helped build a stretcher. Thankfully, her memory of being dropped several times was foggy. It's an event that I always had a hard time contextualizing. Were we really in danger? Was it just a taste of adventure in what was ultimately more of an inconvenient situation than a full-on disaster? There were maybe only one or two moments I was actually frightened over the course of the 12-hour ordeal, and the moment that was by far the most terrifying was when I almost got exploded, which happened after we were rescued and was mostly my fault. Recently, I reconnected with Jono, who's still a good friend of my sister. We hadn't talked in years, and pretty quickly after we saw each other, we started reminiscing about the camping trip. I told him how even though it was scary, I didn't feel like we were ever in any real danger because he and the other counselors didn't seem that stressed out. Nobody did. Jono was like,
"Really? That's not true at all. I was stressed as fuck. It completely traumatized me. It was one of the worst things that ever happened to me. I was 100% sure we were all going to die out there."
I was like, "Yeah, but when you think about it, it's still kind of a funny story, isn't it?" Jono was like,
"Nope, not at all."
I'd like to thank my father, Mark, my mother, Sandy, my sister, Dania, my brother-in-law, Max, my nephews, Joe and Gideon, my wife, Lauren, my dog, Zelda, for being my wonderful and loving family without whom I could not function. Thank you very much.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Yearbook, read by Seth Rogen and a full cast.